A new call for less regulation.
And it comes from President Obama.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, the 18th of January. Coming up, we're going to ask about Apple's future prospects following yesterday's announcement that CEO Steve Jobs will take a medical leave of absence.
Also, there's a rat at number 10 Downing Street, a real one, and one Brit thinks that's a good thing.
All right. But first, President Obama issued an executive order today requiring that federal agencies review regulations that might hurt economic growth. The president also wrote an opinion piece on the subject in this morning's Wall Street Journal. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more from Washington.
Aviation analysts expect all the airlines to book a combined profit of $400 million for the fourth quarter of last year. That reverses a loss of $800 million the previous year. What's up with the airlines? Airline analyst Daryl Jenkins says they're following the economy.
A robust economy is an airline's best friend. It always has been and it always will be. It's what makes airline traffic improve.
But there are clouds on the horizon. The price of jet fuel is on the rise. Oil prices climbed back over $90 a barrel last month. Jenkins says it'll be hard for the airlines to make a profit if oil gets up to $105 per barrel. One way the airlines deal with the risk is by hedging, locking in their jet fuel at a certain price. Southwest Airlines did that and made out very well at first, but it ended up losing money when oil prices fell. Jenkins says everybody's too paranoid to do much hedging now, because they don't know which way oil prices are headed. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
For some analysis now, let's bring in Julie Neiman. She's an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she joins us now from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So first of all, why do you think the president is doing this?
Well, he's becoming very Clinton-esque, business-friendly. The reality, though, is the economy is expanding, but employment is not. Now, regulation is necessary because crimes have been committed, but it always is a cost to business, and the question is it effective? So the big problem here is business is delaying expansion, large business, trying to figure out what the cost is going to be and will it be effective.
And would fewer federal regulations lead businesses to add more jobs?
Well, it'll help unemployment probably as much as lowering the corporate tax rate will, too. Government jobs are going up in the regulatory areas. But for small businesses, it's not going to help. The small businesses are the ones who lead you out of a recession. Competitors dry during the recession. Companies have an opportunity to expand. If they can get the lines of credit, then they basically want to start expanding at the local level. The real problem, though, state and local and federal regulation, not the federal regulation.
Right.
St. Louis has 94 suburbs surrounding the city. We have business prevention departments in the form of city and county licensing and inspection. This is what squashes small businesses, is state and local rather than federal regulation.
All right, Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thanks so much.
You bet.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, January 18th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Let's get to the global perspective now. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? President Hu Jintao of China will be visiting the United States starting today. He'll be meeting with President Obama at the White House. And one thing they'll probably talk about is in this morning's Financial Times. It's a report that the Chinese lend more to developing countries than the World Bank, an agency with a mission to lend to developing countries. From Shanghai, the BBC's Chris Hogg reports.
China has a lot of cash available to try to win friends and influence. In fact, the country has about $2 trillion of cash in reserve. One thing China has been doing with that money is buying U.S. debt. But the country, through two state-owned banks, has also been using it for something else, furthering China's national interests by funding projects in poorer countries. Patrick Chovanec is from Tsinghua University's School of Economics and Management in Beijing. He says it's easier to invest in these emerging markets than in the U.S. or Europe.
A lot of Chinese companies that find it difficult to enter a highly competitive market in North America or Europe find that their products or their infrastructure projects are very welcome in developing countries.
But it doesn't come for free. Loans are granted in return for guarantees of energy supplies, for promises to open up markets for Chinese goods, or simply to win support for Chinese policies at places like the UN. In Shanghai, I'm the BBC's Chris Hogg for Marketplace.
Also today, American companies meet with a lot of the visiting Chinese delegation to talk over and to sign new partnerships in clean energy. Now, in the past, businesses have had concerns about sharing technology with China, but as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports from the Sustainability Desk, now they can't afford not to.
David Sandilow is an assistant secretary at the U.S. Department of Energy. He was on the road in China recently, riding in a car going about 60 miles an hour.
From behind me came the bullet train, going at about 220 miles an hour. It was amazing to see this thing shoot by.
Shoot by us. That's what he says China's poised to do in clean energy. Everything from high-speed rail, electric cars, and clean coal technology.
The view that they have a lot to learn from us, and we have nothing to learn from them, is out of date.
That's in part because China is growing faster than the U.S. More demand for power and transportation means more chances to innovate. But China's central government is also dictating the switch to clean energy, and fast, says Ken Lieberthal at the Brookings Institution.
Where it may take 6 years to get regulatory approvals to build a carbon capture project in the United States, in China it'll take 2 years.
He says U.S. companies are coming up with new ideas, but China is an increasingly attractive place to try them out. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., moms-to-be get 12 weeks unpaid leave. In Britain, they already get way more than that, 6 months maternity leave and even some of their salary. Now, couples in the UK will be able to share the benefits with new fathers who are able to take advantage of the time off. From London, the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
If a woman decides to go back to work before the end of her maternity leave, these changes mean a father can use up any of the remaining time. At the moment, men get 2 weeks paid paternity leave, but from April, they could be away from the office for as many as 6 months. Andrew Cave is from the Federation for Small Businesses. He says this could be disastrous for his members and a bad thing for the economy.
The average business in this country employs 4 people. At the moment, if you lose a quarter of your workforce, it is very problematic. The government is introducing disincentives for businesses to take on more staff, just as they're saying that small businesses will be creating the jobs in the future.
But the government says the current rules are old-fashioned, with mums taking on the bulk of the childcare, while men miss out on time with their children. And they believe spending time with your kids in the early stages of life helps with the child's development and creates happier working parents. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Perhaps some good news now for the future of the British economy. Steve, TV viewers in the UK caught a glimpse of an uninvited guest at the Prime Minister's house over the weekend.
Oh, really?
Yes, during a live news broadcast at number 10 Downing Street, a big rat scurried behind the reporter past the door, the front door at 10 Downing Street.
Scurried.
Exactly. That's what rats do. They scurry.
Scurry.
Well, one Brit had this hopeful comment after the sighting. Well, at least the rats aren't deserting yet, so the ship of state can't be sinking yet.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, January 18th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Well, the debate over health care reform is back this week as Republicans in the House of Representatives plan a vote to repeal the new health care law. There are obvious political implications of the vote, but there are implications for the health care industry as well. Alan Miller is the CEO of Universal Health Services. It's a company that owns a couple hundred hospitals around the country. And Alan Miller joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you having to adjust amid all this back and forth in Washington about the health care law?
Well, we have not adjusted much to it at the moment because we're not sure what it will ultimately be. And also, most of the provisions don't go into effect until 2014. But we are certainly very interested, involved, and studying it carefully.
As you were watching the whole healthcare debate go down and everybody was talking about trying to figure out ways to bring down costs, were you sitting there at any point screaming at the TV going,
this is the way you've got to bring down costs. I mean, how do you bring down costs?
My favorite way would be to see us get into malpractice reform. Would save on premiums. It would save on defensive medicine. The law mostly focused on extending coverage. And I think that's a good thing. And that would add more people with coverage. And the hospitals would have more people, more patients.
You've been in the business for now decades. What is the biggest change you've noticed, and where are we going in the world of healthcare at this point?
Well, one thing that's happening is that we are all aging, and the percentage of Americans over 65, 75 and up is increasing very, very rapidly. And just think about some advertising. At one time, you had younger people, they were smoking outdoors and on ski slopes, etc. And now if you look at the advertising, it's for erectile dysfunction and it's for diabetes
right.
and it's for overweight. So we're going to need a lot more by way of nursing. We're going to need more doctors. We're going to need more hospital beds as the decades come upon us.
Alan Miller, President and CEO of Universal Health Services, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
The American economy is so different today than it once was. A lot of manufacturing plants have closed. You and I have talked about that a lot, Jeremy.
Absolutely.
Obviously it's in the news a lot. But what happens after the closing announcement is made? Author Paul Clemens chronicled the shutdown of the Bud Company plant. It was a big plant in Detroit that for decades made panels and stamped parts for the big car makers. His book, Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant, is out today, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why were you so interested in telling this story?
It seemed to me an unexplored area. We see all the time the headline, plant to close. And it dawned on me that I didn't know what happened then. And, you know, what I found was that taking apart industry is itself an industry. And what I try to do is track that process. And so press lines went to Mexico, they went to Brazil, and those that were scrapped went all over.
You actually observed the disassembling of this equipment, right, with these what you call riggers, right?
Yeah, I observed it as often as I could and as best I could, and it's an amazing process. You know, you try to convey to a reader just how big these things are. I mean, you're talking about presses that weigh 1 million pounds. I described in the book as looking like several Stonehenges of steel, and that's what a stamping plant looks like and a press shop looks like.
But when it's done, it's done. And I can imagine you're from Detroit watching this happen. I mean, what was going through your mind?
Yeah, it's a sad process to watch. But what I hope comes through in the book, I think it does, is there's a vitality to the guys in the book. There's a bedrock decency and insight into what they have to say about the process that I think makes it somehow uplifting, even though what it's describing is not.
We keep hearing about an American automotive comeback. Do you see it?
I hope so. It's something you certainly want to root for. To me, Detroit and this auto plant are not really the subject of the book. They are the setting of the book. The subject of the book is wither the working class, wither industrial America. You know, if I were in Pittsburgh, maybe I would have written about a steel mill fired down south, a textile mill. I mean, that's just the setting. It's my way into the topic. The topic is really, what do we do now?
Paul Clemens, author of Punching Out, 1 Year in a Closing Auto Plant. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can check out the Bud Company plant inside our big book blog at marketplace.org. Finally, I remember as a kid, Jeremy, how important it was to have nice handwriting. You're a little mm-hmm. younger than I am, but they gave you a grade for it. I don't know if they did that for you, too.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Penmanship? Absolutely.
For that. Yeah.
But that was a long, long time ago when I was writing on cave walls.
Of course, those days
when hieroglyphics and all that stuff. Well, kids these days have laptops and cell phones made for texting. That's what they're doing all the time. They're not writing anything down.
Just texting.
Yeah. In Georgia, starting next year, they've eliminated teaching cursive writing. Remember, you have to learn how to write in cursive.
Here we go.
Either cursive or block lettering. Yeah, from the statewide curriculum, the beginning of the end, he says.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that someone's going to come up with an iPhone app for your kid's iPhone, right, that's going to teach you cursive.
Oh, I'm sure that they will. But, Steve, the problem is when the iPhone breaks one day, they're not going to even know how to write anything.
That's right. They're going to have to write it in longhand or they're just going to have to communicate verbally. That's what I have to do.
There's always downsides.
Yeah,
that's right.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.